Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and as always, I'm joined by my expert panel. From the City of Angels, we have Ace Attorney and the man we call the Voice of Reason, Peter Haven. Peter, welcome.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Simon. Thank you very much. Happy St. Patrick's Day Eve to everyone.
Right, indeed. Also from, I believe, the same region, psychologist Dr. Gary Penn. Gary, welcome.
Thank you very much. Hello, men. Men, yes. Let's see if at some point we'll get a female in here.
Right.
And she'll tear us to shreds, yes.
And from Youngstown, Ohio, activist, author, and these days teacher, Sam Moffey. Sam, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being here. Top of the afternoon to the fellow members of the audience and the guest.
I do believe that... Bill Conrad will be joining us, but he had some technical problems, and I'm waiting for him to dial back in.
Hey, Simon, he's from New Jersey, right?
Absolutely.
So is he stuck in traffic?
Right. The gate state. Two things happened yesterday, one was a rather depressing and thought-provoking email from Peter Haven. It was all about the state of the world, it's an icky place. He was basically saying that there are no good news stories, you know, to cover anymore. It's all doom and gloom. The second was, you know, a chat with a musician friend of mine, Tokyo Rosenthal. If you're a fan of the Americana genre, he's a name that you will recognize. He tops the Americana charts quite often. I love Toke. You know, his work is uniquely depressing. And with tomorrow being St. Patrick's Day, and, you know, with Peter's rather... depressing email. I think it's only appropriate that we play a few bars of Toke's song, St. Patrick's Day. Just get us all in the mood.
Patrick's Day, I know what you're doing, I know what you're doing. Prayers in hell your way, I know what you're doing, I know what you're doing. I could feel it here, a thousand miles away. You self-medicate, but it's too late. Treat you like a kid. I can't say I'm sorry. You're so full of fear. You can't say you're sorry. You can't say you're sorry. In your time machine. But don't be fooled. It won't make you feel like I do.
I'm sure everyone is suitably depressed. Okay.
That was some fantastic static, Simon. I love that.
Perfect. Okay. I'm looking at the switchboard, and it keeps changing around. Do we have Bill Conrad on the line these days?
Yes, back. Can you hear me clearly?
Yep.
William.
Okay. Peter, I want to run down your list because I think it's so delightful. But before we do that, I sent you a link to I can't even pronounce it, an amicus brief or amicus. What did
yeah,
you make of that?
Well, I thought it was very interesting. It's an amicus brief, which is it's what you file with an appellate court when you're not a party on an appeal, but you feel that the appeal to the appellate court addresses some significant issue that affects you as an interested public citizen. And it's called an amicus curiae brief, and that's Latin for friend of the court. So entities file these briefs whenever there are compelling issues going on and they feel that their voice needs to be heard in connection with them. And the court has the option of hearing these briefs or receiving these briefs or not. And, you know, generally speaking, courts tend to accept these things just to get the point of view. And this apparently was a brief submitted by an attorney on behalf of the National Rifle Association, who was submitting a brief in support of the ACLU's appeal of, I guess, the a ruling on these surveillance issues that many of us have talked about. And the NRA attorney was basically saying that these surveillance issues violate the Constitution because, among other things, it allows the government to find out who are members of the National Rifle Association, and that could be a severe deprivation of their privacy and their security and their, their constitutional liberties.
Let me give you the exact quote. Because I just happened to have it up on one of my monitors. Blah, blah, blah. Since the debates leading up to the enactment of the Gun Control Act of 1968, Congress has recognized that excessive government record keeping on gun owners inhibits the exercise of Second Amendment rights. The mass surveillance program raises issues. First, it could provide government with a means of identifying members and others who communicate with the NRA and other Second Amendment advocacy groups. Second, it could provide a means of identifying gun owners without their knowledge or consent, contrary to long-standing congressional policy. Ooh! I mean, it makes me it makes me quake. I mean, Peter, what, you know, it, do you think this kind of story is going to hold any sway in the court case?
Well, I think they've obviously received the brief, and the justices will read it and consider it. But I don't think, at the end of the day, these particular concerns expressed by the NRA will have a tremendous impact on their decision making. I guess it's a little unclear to me what the various rules and regulations are throughout the United States, but I was under the impression that anyone who owns a gun has to be a registered owner of that gun by law. Now, maybe some states don't have that requirement, but to me, it seems as if every gun should be registered and its owner identifiable by the government. And I don't see any problem with that. And I don't know, you know, in California, I believe that is the law, and I don't know if there are states that have different laws in that regard, but I just don't have a problem with the government being able to say, okay, this person owns this firearm. And I don't see why anybody would oppose that. But I open it up to discussion.
Right. Well, you know, I look at it in terms of motor vehicles to drive on the road. Don't you need a license? And, you know, isn't there registration of the vehicle? I find it incomprehensible that the NRA should take this stance. Gary, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, you know, when you work in my field and you work, well, let's say, with what you call access to diagnosis, which is characterological issues, meaning that if you're depressed or anxious, you don't want to be depressed or anxious, and you're anxious, that's the wrong word, but you're anxious not to be anxious anymore. And so you want to go to therapy to help that. But things that are characterological, like, let's say, paranoid personality disorder, you don't think you have a problem. You actually think someone is following you. And so the paranoid person, it actually calms them down to be paranoid. They don't think they have a problem. So what happens with the NRA is, and I think this is an institutional position on them, they feed on the fears of others. And so for these people, it doesn't seem like it's a problem at all. It actually seems like it's an attribute. And, you know, the idea of what the NRA is saying, of course, is that they are terrified of the government knowing that I have a gun and the government coming into my house and taking my gun away. So this is, and it's gotten to the extreme of this thought process to the point of if you're the Surgeon General or you're a doctor and you make write a paper that says, like with cigarettes, guns can be dangerous to your health, you could be arrested. And so it's gotten to the point where it's really a sense of, again, it's a very fundamentalist position, and when you find fundamentalist people thinking, whether it's in religion or in this case gun ownership, it's just a very dangerous thing. And there's really any kind of reason that you can have, that Peter can have or you can have or anyone can have, it's not going to satisfy anyone. And then of course when you have this surveillance, well, that's just putting their paranoia on steroids, because you know, even a broken clock is right twice a day. And so they are really getting very intense, and this is just making their issues that much more intense for them.
Sam.
Yeah, I agree very much with what Gary just said, and I'd like to add something to it. You know, frequently in litigation, you encounter an adversary, and their tactic in litigation is simply to oppose everything. And no matter how rational or reasonable the proposal is on the table, they will oppose it. And no matter what their legal obligation or duty is, they will oppose it. And if the law appears to be clear in some regard, they will contest the clarity of the law, and they will demand that a court rule on it. And if a fact appears to be established beyond a reasonable doubt or any doubt, they will nevertheless still continue to oppose it. So in addition to, I think, all the things that Gary talked about, some people just adopt a negotiating stance or a policy position of absolutely no compromise, no acquiescence, object to everything, object, and try to make it sound as plausible and reasonable as you can, even though deep down they know that what they're advocating is unreasonable, irrational, or just flat out wrong. And I think in the course of making these arguments, there are these appeals to broad-based paranoia in which massive numbers of people will say, that's right, that could happen, that's the fear, that's what you're doing. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing to have to go up against because it's impossible to make any headway, in my opinion.
Right, it's impossible to disprove a negative. Like, well, what if someone is following me? And you can't disprove that.
Right. Can you guarantee me this is not going to happen?
Yeah, exactly.
I get that a lot. Well, can you guarantee me that there's absolutely no risk at all?
All right. I want to get the rest of the panel involved. Sam, I know that you likely haven't read this marvelous document, but do you have any comments for us?
What was the original case that the NRA is a friend of the court on, Peter?
The original case is an appeal called the plaintiff in the case was the American Civil Liberties Union and the New York Civil Liberties Union and Foundation against the defendants were James Clapper as Director of National Intelligence, Keith Alexander as Director of National Security, Charles Hagel, Secretary of Defense, Eric Holder, Attorney General, and Robert Mueller III in his capacity as Director of the FBI. So it's basically ACLU and related entities completely against government and the exercise of these surveillance measures that we've been talking about recently.
Okay. So they're suing to end it or to make it more open, or what's their
It's unclear because the NRA in this brief is only advocating its own position, but this is an appeal from a district court ruling in which the district court, I gather, refused to declare unconstitutional the activities of these agencies in the course of gathering surveillance. And I suspect what the district court said was, well, existing law provides for it, and we're just a district court. We do what the upper courts and Congress tell us to do, so we don't have the authority to declare these things to be unconstitutional.
So they kick the can down the road. Okay.
Well, they don't have a choice. They don't have discretion to change the law. They have to kick it up.
Okay, got it. Okay, understand. I just wanted to get a little clarification on that. So as far as that goes, that part I'd probably be more interested in commenting on and dealing with, but I think we've talked about this before. I think that's part of Rand Paul's lawsuit. It's already in the Supreme Court. There's probably all this synergy between all these type of lawsuits that, as you predicted weeks, months ago, Peter, was going to be played out in front of the Supreme Court. So I think that's right on. As far as the NRA protecting its own position, what a surprise. You know, like you said, Peter, I think federal law comes out of state law that everyone has to who buys a gun has to register it. So they're in a database. I mean, that's how they, whenever these tragedies take place, you know, the FBI automatically already know who it is. Like, for instance, when that horrific shooting took place in Newtown, people found out it was the mother was a member of the NRA. She was a gun enthusiast who was killed by her son. But her son was, you know, crazy. But they knew
right
away about
That's not entirely true, right? Not all gun purchases are registered. You can go to a gun show.
Those are called illegal gun purchases.
No,
right?
you can go to a gun show and buy a gun. And
you
guess
have to
what?
There's no background. There's a mandatory waiting period.
No.
Why they do a background check on you?
No,
well,
not if you buy it from a gun show.
Well, let's just take a step back.
How can you walk out of there without a gun? If I'm wrong. I've been wrong more than I've been right in my life. In Ohio, you go to buy a gun at a gun show, gun store, gun anything, you got to register and wait 5 or 10 days for them to do a background check on you. And then they say, okay, you've been cleared, and you put a deposit down to buy the gun, then you go back with the balance. That's how it is in Ohio. I guess states are different then.
I don't know the laws of each state. My understanding was that every state basically required some form of registration and licensing, whatever it might be. Now, maybe there are some states that don't abide by that rule. I don't know. But the real question that's before us is, shouldn't that be the rule? I mean, shouldn't it really be the case that if you're going to own a firearm, it should be registered, and you should be the registered owner, and there should be government knowledge that you own that firearm? And personally, I think there should be some type of licensing that's involved, whatever it is. And so if people agree that at a minimum that much should be done, and I think that much should be done, then I don't see what the problem is with knowing the identities of every gun and every person who owns a gun, because it's basically like cars. It's a public record, accessible, you know, it's a government record. It may not be a public record, but it's a government record, and government should be able to monitor and regulate that, in my opinion.
Let me bring Bill into the conversation. Bill, I'd love to get your comments.
You know, it just seems like a no-brainer to me. Again, it's like registering your vehicle. It's out there. I don't know what the NSA would be afraid of. Is it just that it's too convenient that it's in one database, where it might take a day or two to collect everything? And I don't understand their problem. The problem I have is, you know, just collecting all kinds of information, but to feel paranoid that they're going to come and collect all the gun-toting people in the United States. I mean, they can do that now. It has nothing to do with this with the NSA at this point, right?
Right, but I don't know if you caught this aspect, Peter. In the amicus brief, I found this wonderful quote. In New York City, for example, rifle and shotgun registration lists have been repeatedly used to order the surrender or removal of firearms that had once, and you know, emphasis on the word once, been lawfully registered by their owners, but were later prohibited in the city due to design features or magazine capacity. Now, that's in my mind, and I'm going to be super simplistic, it is a bit like saying, you know, in the 1930s, you could build an atom bomb in your basement. Life was good. But, you know, we've since learned that atom bombs aren't really great things to have at home, you know, so you can't do it anymore. And if you have one, we're going to take it away from you. Am I incorrect on that thought, Peter?
I agree with your logic. I mean, we're not talking about atom bombs, but fundamentally, I agree with what you're saying, and that is, I believe that what that quote is suggesting is that New York regulates firearms to the extent that at certain points in time the possession of certain firearms becomes illegal because for whatever reason the legislature of New York has declared that this firearm shall not be legal, that firearm shall not be legal. Therefore, anybody who happens to own that firearm becomes subject to that legislation. Now, I don't know if it's true, in fact, that the government comes in and takes the firearm or not. And if they do, what the quote doesn't say is whether or not the owners are compensated for that taking of firearms. I think they have a right or an expectation of that. But generally speaking, I don't have any problem with that. me personally, I don't have any problem with that. Now, obviously, you know, what Gary was talking about earlier is, and what I was talking about, if you have a constituency that thinks that that is some sort of tremendous fear of government doing that, and you want to oppose that effort, then you fan those flames, and you cite to these kinds of things as atrocities that cannot be tolerated in a civilized society, when I actually think that the opposite is probably true. But that's where the whole debate is, in my opinion.
And Gary, back to you. You've heard the back and forth. Do you have any further thoughts? He said nope. That's first time I've ever heard Gary.
I said nope. I think we lost poor Gary. We bored him to death.
Oh,
poor Gary.
Gary, if you're
out there listening, please come back. We need you.
He's back.
Oh, thank God.
Oh, no, we lost him again.
Well,
He's having technical
difficulties. The parties that conduct the various forms of surveillance are now intercepting and blocking his ability to communicate with the audience here, which, you know, is to be expected.
Okay, I do believe that Gary is back. Gary?
Yeah, sorry, guys.
No problem.
My only thought is that when you think in terms of black and white thinking, and you're thinking, you know, and this is based on fear. This is all based on fear, by the way. Black and white thinking is what happens when things are very dire. It's like when 9/11 happened, and the idea of George W. Bush being in charge for a nanosecond felt good because he wasn't a deep thinker. And when you think in terms of black and white thinking, well, you know, I think the people who are the zealots on the right, and there's some left as well, but mostly on the right, the NRA people, they would be, if we all had 50 caliber submachine guns in case the government wanted to take over their town. And anything less than that is an abomination. It's basically, it's an abomination. And so when all the panel seems to be relatively reasonable and logical, and you say, well, I don't see why we can't do this, well, you just become Charlie Brown's teacher, and the people on the right are not interested in hearing a rational, logical position because they are fundamentally set in their ways.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I think we've done the NRA to conclusion. Unless
shot
anyone.
Shot him down.
What was that, Sam?
I said we shot the NRA to hell.
We did. Okay.
Well, I'm pretty sure they'll shoot back.
You're right. So I'm going to go on to Peter's depressing list.
It's not all depressing, Simon. That's not fair. It's not all depressing.
Right. In fact, I'm going to read the email. Blade Runner going down. Plane going down. Ukraine going down. Religion going down. Climate going down. Tea Party going down. Everything is a real downer. Peter,
I thought I phrased it differently.
Right.
Oh yeah, you're right. I said everything. Well, I apologize for saying everything. That goes against one of my general rules, which Gary just referred to, and I agree that you try not to paint things in black or white terms. There are many shades of gray in the world. So I apologize for using the word everything there. That's not characteristic of my vocabulary. I apologize.
Okay,
this is a downer, but I think I got on a roll there, and I just couldn't stop. So that's what happened.
So let's run down the list. Blade Runner going down. Now, I'm certain you're talking about Oscar Pistorius, I think his name is. Do you see any hope for him in the court system?
Well, to me, as I've said before, this case it sounds a lot like the Phil Spector case in that there are certain similarities here. There was all this commotion in the Phil Spector case about the testimony of other women who he pointed guns at and behaved in a violent and irrational way towards. And there's been testimony in this case about Oscar's behavior, violent behavior with guns and violent behavior in general in what we call prior acts. And to me, that's the stuff that the public and the newspapers and the media seize upon is really like the big sexy evidence, so to speak. But in my opinion, the case really doesn't end up turning on that kind of stuff. It turns on smaller, less conspicuous facts. And in this particular case, as with the Spector case, there appear to be a number of statements and items of evidence that contradict the defense theory that this was some sort of accidental shooting. And in the Spector case, what happened was immediately after these shots were fired, or shot was fired, I should say, the limo driver in that case reported that Spector emerged with a gun and said to the limo driver, "I think I just shot her." Basically, I'm paraphrasing that words to that effect. And that statement was subject to great dispute at the trial, but that was, in effect, the limo driver's testimony. And in this case, in Oscar's case, there appears to have been some exchange between Oscar and a security guard immediately after neighbors reported hearing gunshots. And according from what I understand, the security guard testified that Oscar told him that there was no problem, everything was okay. And all the other evidence that everyone seizes upon is certainly fodder for argument by the attorneys, but at the end of the day, statements like that, to me, are particularly damning. Because if the jury hears the security guard say, "He called me, I had a conversation with him," and I think the evidence is the security guard got reports and then called Pistorius and said, "Is everything okay?" And Pistorius said, "Yes, everything's fine." So if the jury believes that that's what Pistorius told the security guard, then, you know, it's very hard to interpret that evidence in any way other than an attempt to cover up what happened. And if, in fact, this was an accidental shooting, it's the more likely response, or the response that people would want to hear more is, "Oh my God, it was an accident. I shot her. Call 911. Get an ambulance here. Get me some help. Do something." So it appears to be part of a cover up, and that's very difficult to get around. And that leads me to the second point, which is that, you know, if you're a defendant, if you're the attorney for the defense here, and you want the jury to believe that this was an accident, then it seems to me you're going to have to put the defendant on the witness stand to allow the defendant to explain everything that happened. Otherwise, the jury just hears item of evidence after item of evidence after item of evidence, and it's difficult for the jury to reach any other conclusion other than you're the one who did it. And so unless you get on the witness stand and explain it, it's very hard to overcome these items of evidence. And, of course, you know, Inspector, they never put him on the witness stand. And I don't know if they're going to put Oscar on the witness stand in this case or not. But I kind of think it's you're darned if you do and you're darned if you don't. If you put him on the stand, then they're just going to fillet him on cross-examination and drag him all over the place and ask him, among other things, about this comment that he made and all kinds of stuff, and that can be worse than if he doesn't testify at all. But either way, from my observation of the evidence, it seems likely that the jury's only going to reach one conclusion. But who knows? Who knows? I don't know the jury pool. I don't know how sympathetic South African jury pool is going to be to him. I tend to have faith that, you know, truth and justice generally prevails in these things.
And Sam, have you been following the Oscar?
Just the bits and pieces of the one. Like, for instance, like, I know that his watches were allegedly, his Rolex watches were stolen by the police. There's a lot of, I've been following more of the claims of the police bungling of the handling of the crime scene, and that supposedly the big story in South Africa was not what Peter was talking about, or, you know, the actual law, the evidence and whatnot, but the cops went in and stole all of the jewelry when his expensive watches are missing. So is the life of a celebrity who's allegedly shot his girlfriend as a intruder. I don't know. I've been following it that much. It's probably to South Africa what some of our celebrity killings have been to us, but for some reason it's not playing on Quick TV. I mean, it's kind of funny considering that the guy is a worldwide athlete and celebrity and, you know, of that, and she was a model. I think she was a model, a world-famous model. I'm surprised it hasn't had the play on American television, American courts, that some of these other ones have, or that our celebrity trials have had around the world. But that's the only thing I've been finding is that the big questions, at least in the, when I read the BBC and some other news and whatnot, is that the police handling of the investigation is in question, I guess, or that the original crime scene kind of reminds me of a case that Peter Haven's familiar with when OJ, where they were able to make the cops look like a bunch of Keystone cops in the investigation, and I think that helped poison the jury's mind, and looks like that's what the Pistorius lawyers are taking a page from the OJ lawyers' playbook to muddy up the waters and take people away from the real evidence and things of that nature and throw in all this other crap like they were talking, that was what they were talking about in South Africa. Do you think the cops stole the watches? Not if he killed the girl, did the cop steal his watches? Sorry. No, it's not a real pressing issue in my household.
Right.
Nor in most households in the United States.
Bill, do you have any thoughts on Oscar?
Well, I have been following this a little bit, more than, you know, I didn't think it was such newsworthy for us, but it was kind of interesting. They are actually broadcasting it in South Africa. They started up a 24-hour courts channel to cover this. So it's on 24/7 right now. And there are parts of the court case that they don't broadcast live. They film it and they play pieces of it back, kind of like the Olympics. And it is being followed by O.J. Simpson. They're all concerned because now children have access to figure out what happened. They're actually doing this kind of like a O.J. Simpson. The interesting point that was it Peter that said that they only gave a piece of it to get you to kind of follow it, and they're doing it in such a way to keep you hungry to hear more about the news. It's almost like they're not letting him testify because they want to have this big, spectacular news program about this court case, and it's kind of a media circus here, there, and they're doing it the same way they did it with O.J. So they're not, they're purposely, it seems like they're purposely not letting him speak, and they're just showing him with, oh my God, this has really happened, and she's really dead, and what am I going to do with the rest of my life? Oh my God, how did this ever happen? And they're just like building everything in the background up to this. One of the news films that I got to see had a piece where she was with Reva was out playing swimming with dolphins the day before and setting up for kind of a nature film, And so that's just, it's just the whole thing is a media circus. It's very interesting to watch.
Gary, this definitely is in your area of expertise. And do you think that the media has cut the legs out of or off of Oscar?
Simon.
I couldn't resist
Simon.
It.
Wow. Well
Simon.
Done, man. You should take a knee on that one. That was not bad.
Oh, that's
Gary with a comeback.
Wow.
Oh, brutal. Okay.
Well, look, it's the media is velociraptors, and, you know, it's all, it's, you know, look, there's a whole swath of the media that's just spectacular and wonderful. And then you have the weather girl on the news with the gigantic tits. And so, you know, it's all a combination of both. So it's all about milking it and titillating and money. Probably if I'm just being a drive-by person, yeah, probably he killed her. Probably he killed her in a state of rage and passion. And again, you know, what would happen if he didn't have a gun in the house? But we could just go back about 20 minutes and have a redo on that. But, you know, it's just, it's tragic. It's horrible. It's about narcissism. It's about, look at me. When some people tell you that you are the greatest, you know, via OJ and everything you do, that your, you know, crap smells like roses over and over and over again, you get this sense of invincibility. And I'm sure my guess is that's probably what happened. It's hard to believe that he shot into the bathroom without saying, who is that? I mean, that's like, wow, what a mountain to climb. Who's there? It's like so funny. It's me. I've got a gun. Who's there? It's me. Oh, I forgot to ask that. I just shot. So, but it's just the dark side, and it's, the media is, you know, they're just getting ratings, and everyone's getting a nice bonus.
Sam, I'm going to drop the Oscar story very shortly, but...
Well, after that pun, you should be spanked.
Well, no, I've got one more for you. There's a hot rumor that if he gets off scot-free, he doesn't OJ, he's going to move into politics, and he'll be out there stumping.
Oh, I thought you were going to say running for office. That is brutal. You know what, Simon, that's done. Really bad. I mean,
I am not worthy. Yes. Well done, Simon.
Simon's having as much fun with Oscars as I did with the cows. I don't know if we'll get off, but I will tell you one thing. She was one hot babe. The wife that he didn't kill or killed who was in the bathroom. But you put up a great point, Gary. Why would someone break into someone's bathroom to use it? Was he in the bathroom or was she in the bathroom?
I've been there before. Yeah, I would do that.
Oh, I guess Bill's following it. Was he in the bathroom with his gun and shot out?
No.
One of the guesses is that she was hiding from him in the bathroom, you know, like if ever you get an intruder
right.
coming into the house.
Right, okay. That makes sense. That makes sense.
And he,
okay.
And he shot like four or five times through the bathroom door, like, oh,
yeah.
I've run out of ammo from my six shooter. Who's there? You know?
You know, the very question
So basically what he's saying, someone was staking out my cool pad, and they figured the way to wealth was through my bathroom window.
I hate it when they take my toothbrush. I hate it.
You know, these are,
well, we all know the cop stole
these...
his watches. So, okay, got it. All right. Now I understand.
These are precisely the kinds of questions, in my opinion, that the jury will ask. You know, for me personally, I don't know how big everyone's bed is, but I personally think I know if someone's sleeping next to me or not. And I certainly think that before I pull out a gun and start firing at a bathroom, I reach over and I try to identify whether or not, you know, the person I went to bed with is there with me. I mean, that's just normal human common sense. I think you know that someone's there or not, but if you have any doubts, you try to ascertain that. So jury's going to be asking these same questions, and if he doesn't explain the answers, I think they're going to be predisposed to reaching certain conclusions.
Wouldn't you have a natural instinct to say, honey,
yes,
get under the bed, there's something wrong? You know what I mean?
Look, you have a natural instinct. You have a natural instinct to know that, you know, your bed partner is either there with you or not there with you, and you certainly have a natural instinct, if you don't intend to kill them, to want to protect them at some level. And to just start firing bullets into a bathroom on these facts is just, in my opinion, very untenable and unreasonable. So I think the jury's going to be asking the same questions in their minds, and unless he explains them, they're not going to be able to draw any other conclusion. And the act of explaining them may only be worse for him. So, you know, I tend to think this is going to have a predictable conclusion, but it's still too early to say.
Oh, okay. Incidentally, it is my belief or my understanding that there is no jury, all right, that there is just a judge.
That's probably worse for him. That's a good point. I didn't know if there was a jury or not. If this is just a judge trial, I actually think that's worse for him. And that further solidifies my sense of where this is going.
What if his name is Lance Ito?
Well, it's not. I think the judge is female. I don't know much else about her, but in any event, if I was a criminal defendant, and if I, you know, I think I would have a better chance having this in front of a jury, where all I would need is one or two jurors to not think that the prosecution has proven reasonable doubt. I think if I'm in front of a judge, that makes it even tougher.
Okay, I'm going to move on down the list. Peter's down list. Plane going down. Now, I was on a radio station in, the Chicago area last Tuesday.
Simon, how many yachts do you water ski behind? Are you on every radio station everywhere?
Something like that. Anyway, I was asked the question, you know, what did I make of, you know, Malaysia Flight 370? And I said, look, you know, Hertz know where their cars are. You know, they've got a, you know, $20,000 car. They want to know where it is. So they have GPS in it. You know, truck companies want to know where their trucks are. They have GPS in them. You now have a $300 million plane that has disappeared. If the technology, you know, is good enough for Hertz, you know, how come it's not good enough for Boeing? I'll open it up. Who wants to talk about planes going down? Well, Peter, it has to be you first, because you're the one with the list.
I don't agree that Boeing. I assume that all airline manufacturers use as much technology as they have available to keep track of their aircraft. I don't know what that technology is, but I assume they're using every bit of technology at their disposal to be able to determine at all point in time where an aircraft is. I don't know why such technology isn't foolproof. I'm not an expert on it. But, you know, I assume they're using everything that Hertz uses and then some. So I don't know if, you know, black boxes or what have you can be disabled. I don't know if they can be tampered with. I don't know if they can malfunction. I don't know if there are gaps in our ability to track aircraft in airspace. I assume there are not, but I don't know, especially if this involves satellites and whatnot. I just don't know. But, you know, the bigger issue to me is that I don't think a plane engages in the kind of behavior that this plane appears to have engaged in unless somebody is trying to misdirect or control the flight through some type of hijacking. It just seems very uncharacteristic behavior for me. It, from what I understand, it appears to have deviated significantly from its intended course. It appears to have dropped out of radio communication. There does not appear to have been any type of Mayday transmission or SOS. Not, you know, we're going down, we're crashing, Mayday, Mayday, what have you. So, you know, I'm sure that there are plausible explanations that this could be due to some sort of catastrophic malfunction. I'm not expert enough to say that that I understand that, but, you know, to me, the more likely scenario is that, you know, somebody exercised some type of undue influence over this aircraft, and I have no idea where it is right now. I don't know if they stole it or blew it up or crashed it. I don't know what it was, but, you know, it's still unfolding, and we'll have to see where the investigation yields, although it appears they're never going to find anything.
Right. You know, I believe today is the eighth day, and that there's absolutely nothing but conflicting information. Gary, have you been following Flight 370 at all?
Yeah, I've been following just, you know, as a layperson, but it's interesting. When I'm hearing all of this, there's this quiet, like, comfort that it was the pilot. And this is obviously from those poor people are dead, and if that's the case. But there's a sense, like, I want my planes to work. And the idea that this, I don't know if this is a Dreamliner, the new one, but I want that plane to be a success. And I want it to fly well, and I want it to be safe. And when I heard that maybe it was, in fact, a pilot who maybe just or someone on the board who took the plane over, on some reason that just made me feel a little better, that maybe we can have more control over that than a structural issue with the plane. So other than that, it certainly is a mystery, and I'm sure it will capture our attention for a long time until life takes over and we things move on, or some basketball player, you know, gets in trouble or whatever. But it's a tragedy. But that's my comment on that.
Okay, Gary, follow up question. Do you think the media has made far too much out of the story? CNN, for example, has been...
Well, don't talk to me about CNN, Peter. Come on. They will sit there and talk about a bowel movement from the toilet's point of view, from the underwear's point of view, from the colon's point of view, and then they're going to interview the maker of the toilet paper, and then they're going to sit there and talk about the guy who made the sewer pipes, and what do you think? And, you know,
that needs to be on YouTube.
Well, I think that the colonic point of view is particularly compelling, in my opinion.
The asshole's point of view is the most important.
Yeah, CNN is just, they should be ashamed of themselves. They're just, Wolf Blitzer should be, like, taken out to a nice little home somewhere and given some porridge and say, listen, we could, it's okay, you don't have to start making, I mean, God bless him, he's got to make a story, whatever the story is. Breaking news, we talked to the best friend's girlfriend's first cousin, and he's got to do that with a straight face, so I hope they pay him a lot of money.
I think they should be forced to watch videos of themselves.
Yes, that'd be a good one.
Through the years, but you're right. That's an excellent.
Yes, so go ahead. I'm sorry, Simon. You got me on CNN, and it got me riled up.
No,
I guess I think call it CNN because it's the Colonic News Network. That's fascinating.
Well done.
I'm in bed with them, so what can I say?
Oh, okay. Well, whatever. We all have to do what we got to do.
Well, we all have our shortcomings. I've got mine.
Hey, listen, if they would pay me, I would be on tomorrow.
Yeah. If they paid me,
are you kidding me?
You know,
yes, my outrage goes only so far. My outrage and my narcissism are always in a battle. And if my narcissism takes over, I'm going to be on national TV. Yes.
Bill, you've been very quiet. What do you make of this airplane that's gone missing?
I don't even know what to say. I mean, I came up with some silly thoughts on it, but I know they're not true. I'm hoping that it's really not aliens, and I'm hoping that I don't know. I guess the one thing that they did say is that as soon as it hit the South China Sea, that it did make a sharp turn to the west, and so now they're looking at other places it may have gone. The technology on the airplane allows for it to use a shorter runway to actually land. So if it was hijacked and it was it did veer off course, the ability for them to land someplace is greatly possible. So I guess that's what we're kind of hoping for, that no one did perish, that maybe they're being held hostage somewhere, and all that's going to come to realization at this point.
I view that as highly, highly doubtful. Okay.
One of the weird things is, though, is that in the newest airplanes, the plane talks to Boeing all the time. So not only did that black box stop working, but also the technical issues back to Boeing saying, hey, you know, I got a problem with this panel, I got a problem with this control. They get regular feeds from the newest jets, letting them know that there is a problem so that they can go back to the airlines and say, you know, we've detected an error, even sometimes before the airline detects it. So that wasn't working either. So there's something fishy here.
Oh, it's all very fishy. Let's move on to
international. Hey, I didn't get to comment on it.
Sure.
I didn't get to comment on the plane. What do you expect when the pilot and the co-pilot are named Gilligan and Skipper, guys? Okay, that was my stab at a humor. All right, now, anyway, my thing is, Bill, I happen to think you have the plausible, you know, I think aliens have to be considered as one of the things on the list based upon the fact that how the hell does a plane that big with all the technology marvel, all the might of the world where it is, go missing as it did? I mean, I think one of those things has to be considered. I mean, I'm not, that's number one. I mean, maybe Spielberg was right with that. I mean, no one ever, to this day, people have never told us the truth about the missing aircraft and ships out of the Bermuda Triangle, other than Steven Spielberg's Close Encounter of the Third Kind. No things have never gone.
And how about Area 51?
How about Area 51? How about Amelia Earhart? We'll never be able to find them. So
as long as we're talking about Hollywood, what was the premise or the theory behind the television show Lost?
I'm playing that one down, right?
It seems to have disappeared and gone into some sort of. I never watched the series. But
it's some jungle, right?
Interdimensional portal.
Remember the flight of the Phoenix? At least we forget the plane alive that crashed and that no one thought would ever survive way up on the Andes Mountains, right? True story. I mean, obviously, the bigger thing that came out of that was how they survived, but of course, they didn't have the technology back then that we have now. But that's what I'm totally flabbergasted about. We talked about the NSA. We talked about everybody having cell phones, our satellites, the ships, the submarines that are out there, the freighter ships, all the, you know, there's a lot of, you know, boats out there, too, and no one saw anything. No computers have picked up stuff. And you know, that, to me, is a very interesting object. You know, now I'm seeing stuff today, this morning, they're talking about this plane probably is hidden. They think it's hijacked on the ground. It hasn't come out yet, but that last comment that came out, good night, all is well, or something like that, I'm probably, the last comment from the cockpit, they now think came from the ground. Now that to me is, okay, they're on the ground. Okay, they've been hijacked, which is like very, I agree with you. Then we know some of the people are safe, and that's a good thing. Because, you know, not knowing where to be a parent or a loved one of those 239 people would be a terrible thing right now. At least if they're hijacked, you know, they got a chance of living. So here's my question to the panel. If they have been hijacked, and this is a sophisticated terrorist plan to take over planes now and land them and find out everything about planes, how come no one's taking credit for it? And then shut down air traffic around the United States, the world. Wouldn't that be the ultimate terrorist right now?
Well, I can provide you with one possible answer to that, and that is that publicity for this act of terrorism is not the intent of people if they did hijack it, that they are doing it for some other purpose, and they want the world to believe that this jet was lost at sea. And one possible explanation for that is they intend to use the jet as some type of weapon. That's just one possible explanation.
That's a fair call. Because someone who wants to hijack it wants asylum, or they want money, and they want the hostages. Those are now hostages, and they're not bargaining chips, correct?
I there are many reasons that hijackers or terrorists do what they do. It appears that if this was an act of hijacking and terrorism, the purpose was not to claim credit for it, and the purpose may or may not have been to destroy it. If in fact it's been forced down somewhere and confiscated, then you have to wonder why would they want to do that? And one possible explanation is what I've talked about. There are millions of others. I don't know which one.
No, that's okay. I wonder. I think these things have to be talked about. But you know what else we have to talk about in this regards to it? How screwed up, you know, I have read, you know, now it's four hijacked passports or stolen passports are on that plane. Not one, not two, nothing. Four. They get into Malaysia where they say, according to terrorist experts from around the world that I've been watching on the various networks I'm reading about, say it's the easiest place in the world to get forged documents, forged passports or whatnot, are on that plane. That's been confirmed. It was two, now it's four. So the plot thickens like a movie or a Tom Clancy novel or something of that nature. But, you know, the ultimate thing that you said, Peter, it's true that if they think that's happened, not if the Malaysian government's out of the picture and the United States and all and the West vast resources in fighting terrorism and air piracy and those type of things is now working overtime to solve this problem, let's say your hunch is right, that first thing you just said. That's a scary thought. The two get on a plane. They have figured out, other than it being pilot suicide, what things to cut to turn a jet into a stealth to fly on the radar. That's pretty incredible considering how much technology is out there going. to the point that the Rolls-Royce engines were giving off pings to tell the, you know, the satellite pings, and that's how they knew it had flown 7 more hours than they thought it had.
Well,
the technology is there, but not when the human devious mind is at work.
Okay, but Tim, earlier this week you made a great comment to me. You know, where was the stinking NSA? There's 239 cell phones on board. I mean, surely they would know.
Well, I just think that that's what made me, when I first heard about this and it disappeared, my first reaction was, this is a terrorist attack. There's something going on. Someone stole this plane for sinister purposes. Because of exactly what that, the NSA, we talked about that, satellites, military, all the shipping, the submarine. Have you ever seen one of these nuclear submarines that they are in the Indian Ocean with the radar they have? I mean, the technology we have in our military and our civilian, and Gary, I agree with you, Boeing and Rolls-Royce and all these people who make these planes, they make them to fly safe, because if they don't, they're out of business. And we want everyone to be safe. I don't want any plane crashes or any of this stuff. You know, I want people to feel safe. But I think for the most part, the technology is amazing considering how we don't have that many plane crashes. The air traffic controllers and all that sort of stuff. You just got to, you know, it's just the engineering, the brain power, the technology, the people screw these things together, the machine. Wow. But one thing it doesn't take into consideration is that when I saw this guy was a pilot, and there was someone, I think it was from Gary's favorite network, CNN, said, how do you flip on the how did the transponder go off? And the pilot just made, just like a light switch. So the human error or the human mind that's been compromised for whatever reason, terrorism, pilot suicide. I mean, there was an Egyptian airline that went down that they found out was a pilot killed everybody on board. Committed suicide. I mean, I don't think you can dismiss that possibility either. But the sequence of events, and now when they're saying that it looks like the American anti-terrorism groups now reporting that the last comment that came from the cockpit appears to have come from the ground, well, I think everyone's worst fears are coming true, and I just hope that they can rescue 239 people who are innocent, no one's hurt, pay the ransom, and I hope that's all it is, because Peter's idea that this thing's been, you know, retrofitted or possibly turned into a missile or a weapon, or even worse, the terrorists know everything about our planes and how they operate and how they can seize more of them. Can you imagine what that would do to the world economy if people find out that at any second this could happen to them on their plane? Next plane flight. Wow.
Well, if in fact it's possible to hijack an entire commercial airline and literally, you know, for lack of a better word, steal it, or even if that's not what happened, if hijackers took it over and destroyed it, how does that make you feel, Sam, about these various surveillance measures that, you know, the government is accused of overusing in an effort to try to combat
terrorism?
Well,
obviously they're not using them correctly, which even scares me even more, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as I understand, a plane of this magnitude is a highly electronic, high-tech item, and that the fact that they could cut, it appears, the transporter, which I believe is that the fancy word for the black box?
No. You cannot cut the black box. But what they
did cannot
cut
the black box.
No. But they cut the transponder and they cut something called
the circuit,
ACARD.
The circuit breaker. Right.
It's a switch.
Okay. So they turn this thing off and immediately that the plane becomes a stealth plane. And Peter, as far as what you just said, I don't want the government spying on the plane. I want the air traffic controllers, the radars from that, finding out where our planes are going. They're the ones ultimately responsible for the safety of that plane. And I think there's something else we have to take into consideration. I was just thinking about, who are these people on the plane? Is there somebody that someone wanted kidnapped? Is there somebody on that? Was there some great scientist or military genius that was on that plane, or that the possible hijackers / terrorists wanted? I don't know. I haven't seen a list of the who was on it, but it's obviously now that to me that humans plotted this thing out for whatever it is, either to blow it up for suicide purposes, which is a sad thing, but to take other people with them, or two, as you said, Peter, I think to hijack it and turn it into a bigger weapon, a huge weapon, if you really think about it, and the fact that our technology that we've been told is supposed to be so good can't find it, that's a scary thought too.
Okay.
If the plane is under a piece of camouflage in Uganistan or someplace like that, that's amazing that that happened.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock. I do want to move down the Peter's list, Ukraine, and I'm watching current news events. This should come as no surprise to anyone. The referendum in the Crimea is over, and just over half the ballots have been counted. Guess what? Only 3.5% of ballots opposed joining Russia. Ouch. I mean, this has moved the situation immensely in my mind. I mean, Russia needs the Crimea. Ukraine needs the Crimea, but for a different reason. There's also some rumors going on that those troops that aren't Russian have now moved into a part of the East Ukraine. Now, those are unconfirmed reports. I mean, whoa, this is looking like Cold War version 2. Wouldn't you agree, Sam?
Absolutely. I think, as a matter of fact, it's my understanding Putin has already ordered his troops in to find the 3.5% of the people who voted against his land grab and hunting them down to kill him. I'm surprised he didn't get 99.9% of the vote. Look, this is what the oligarchs wanted. The Russian, they're the ones who control Russia, and they want total control. Like I said last week, Hillary Clinton's, should have taken back those words and called him Putin's land grab, which is exactly what Hitler did in the 19th, right before World War II. This is, now you have the onslaught. Before we had the Sudetenland went the same way. We have to protect native Russians from the evil Ukrainians. The next thing, where the problem's going to be is when the Tatars, am I pronouncing that right? The Tatars of the Ukraine, as the 12% of their ethnic population, do not want to go back under Russian rule because the Russians have notoriously treated them horrendously over the years. They're going to seek, matter of fact, they boycotted voting for this thing. They're appealing to the Ukrainian government for support. Because and they want the Ukrainian the new Ukrainian government to protect them from what they feel is going to be a Russian onslaught. And, yes, Simon, I've seen those same reports that Russian troops, or supposedly not Russian troops, but our Russian troops, are moving into the Ukraine, and it's all about protecting the gas and the oil and getting a big, and being able to put the squeeze. The oligarchs want more money, and they're going to put the, and Putin's their man, and they're going to put the squeeze on Western Europe for higher gas and gas prices. Right now, Russia's the gas station for Europe, and Putin's going to drive the prices up.
Well, there is a theory put out by certain members of the Tea Party, who shall remain nameless, that what we need to do is send some of our gas to Europe. Now, that's easier said than done. Yeah, it's kind of tough to build a pipeline, but I think they're talking about, you know, LPG products. It sounds outlandish to me, you know, particularly when gas prices are so high here at home. You know, lowering, you know, our domestic supply to help other people doesn't make much economic sense. Let's go to Gary. Gary, what do you make about what's going on in Ukraine?
Well, I wish I can get worked up about it. I have no idea why the right is so worked up about it. I thought John McCain was going to have an aneurysm on the Senate floor. I just don't understand. And again, the Republican thinking, and I'm not necessarily anti-Republican, but I am right now. But they're just not deep thinkers. It's like, let's just, you know, shoot somebody, or let's send them gas. Like, well, why don't you think about it? Why can't Russia be our friend? Why are they our enemy? You know, they're not fine. They have some issues, and they had a lot of issues 50 years ago, and yeah, they went through some dark times. We went through slavery, and we went through Vietnam. It's like, can we just, like stop it already? And the idea of these Republicans who are just kind of salivating at the idea of all of this and all of this bellicose speaking, the idea of sitting down and talking with someone, it, like, pisses them off. These individuals who, I would say most of them, identify themselves with the Prince of Peace. And the idea of, oh, I'm a good Christian, and I'm this, and I'm that, well, fine, walk the walk. Like, walk the walk. I don't know that Russia's our enemy. I just don't know that Russia's our enemy. I don't know that China's our enemy. Yes, we do have national interest, but Russia didn't do anything when we went into Iraq. Like, what, like, they didn't, like, say, well, we're going to send, you know, Stinger missiles to Saddam Hussein. Like, they didn't do that. So I don't know. I'm not going to make Russia into the bogeyman. I don't feel that. Again, and I have to say one thing about this. I am not an expert on, you know, this part of the world, so there may be a lot of things that if an expert would tell me would make me think twice. But from someone who's somewhat politically and worldwide aware, I just don't understand the Republican take on it. I think the Democratic take, the Obama-Kerry take on it, is just much more enlightened. And let's figure this out slowly.
Okay. I like that idea. Peter, do you... Are you in agreement?
Well, I think every rational mind is in agreement that we have to sort of stay back for now and see how this all unfolds. I actually didn't realize that Republicans were so particularly up in arms about this, and it makes me draw parallels to the situation in Syria a while ago, and it seemed to me at that point in time Republicans were arguing that, you know, we shouldn't be interceding or doing anything in the way of getting directly involved in what happened in Syria, which was at the time people believed an effort by
Putin. Peter, I don't mean to interrupt.
Please.
You. It was McCain and Graham wanted to go to war. Gary's right. You're right, Peter. It was Rand Paul and other and more libertarian Republicans who didn't. I just wanted to address that.
Well, I appreciate that because that gets a little confusing to me.
This gets
into the whole Tea Party distinction. You know, to me, a lot of what goes on in terms of certain people's positions with respect to anything in the world, domestically or internationally, is not so much a position per se, but just a contrarian stance to Obama. And I tend to have problems with that because it's hard to have a rational discussion with somebody who's just going to disagree for the sake of disagreeing. With respect to what's going on in the Ukraine and Crimea right now, Gary's right. I mean, I echo those sentiments. There's obviously a lot of history here that I'm personally not aware of. It's unclear to me what the relationship is between these three nations, so-called sovereign nations. The Crimean referendum is supposedly a referendum to secede and join join Russia. Well, what are they seceding from? Are they? I can't tell if Crimea is a separate sovereign entity or if it's a state within the Ukraine, and I think it's a little bit of both. And secondly, you know, just because a state in the United States voted to secede from the United States doesn't mean that that act of secession should be recognized by the national government, and I don't think it would be. A state or a collection of states, but I don't understand the relationship here enough to express a considered opinion on it. And it, other than talking right now or perhaps imposing sanctions, I really don't think there's much more that we could do or that anyone in the world could do other than observe it at this point in time. I just don't think there's much more that can be done at present. But each day is a new development.
Oh, okay. Bill's been very quiet. Do you have any thoughts on Crimea?
Well, again, I'm surprised to hear that the Republicans were so pro-war on this whole thing. And it's if Crimea wants to go to Russia and the voting seems to indicate that, I think we're silly to stand in their way. I think, you know, you can...
Okay, let's not be naive here.
Yeah.
Okay, Bill. The voting's going to that way because that's the way Putin wants it. I agree with you guys. Stay out of it. Totally agree with you. And don't label all the Republicans. It is, Gary, you're right, it is warmonger McCain, which blows me away because here's a guy who knows 7 years as a POW with every bone broken in his upper body, knows how bad war can literally be. And it's the biggest drumbeater for war of the last 8 years. I'm just glad Obama cleaned his clock in 08. We'd be in
It's just not McCain. It's just not McCain. The whole CPAC, everyone except for Rand Paul, wanted to do something that was very intense. So it's just not McCain. It's much more.
Well, I'm sure it is.
It's much more spread out than you might think.
Well, don't forget, as our good friend Manny Balling, Gary, you'd love to talk to him, would say, since 9/11, we've been in a war economy, and all over the world, and we have to take that into consideration. And if you study what's going on in Russia right now, you've got the oligarchs who control and those guys make our billionaires look like pikers. Okay, those 110 families that control most of the wealth in Russia are feeling a squeeze because in Ukraine, the pro-Europe Ukrainian government took over, they were going to, Putin and the oligarchs were afraid of nationalization of those pipelines and things of that nature. There is that story. Does it affect us? No, it doesn't. Does it affect the crazies who think the Keystone Pipeline is going to save the world for economy? Yes, it does. And, you know, but that's a whole separate issue. The issue is, I think, as you guys are all in agreement here, should the United States be saber-rattling against Russia for what they're doing? And I think we all agree, no. Let Russia, if Russia wants, Crimea wants to be part of Russia, even at the bayonet, that's their business.
Okay. Good answer. I'm looking at the clock. We got about 4 minutes left. I'm going to move on to the next item on Peter's list. And I'm not entirely sure what he means. Religion going down. Expand.
Sure. I actually think that these last three topics really kind of lump together, and it's a concept that really requires a lot more discussion. But, you know, I was watching a show the other day. It's one of my favorite shows on television. It's called Through the Wormhole, and I don't know if anybody else watches it, but I, unfortunately, am a bit of a nerd, and I'm fascinated by it. Yeah, well, one of the things they talked about during this episode was this concept of a tipping point. And they were discussing how populations, and the same thing can be said of the natural environment as well, and that's why I link all these together. Populations tend to be subject to tipping points. When a certain percentage of the population has a certain belief or custom or practice, once it exceeds that level, it reaches what's called a tipping point, and then the remainder of the population has to join in because success within the group is dependent upon conforming to this character trait. And one of the things they talked about was language. If a particular culture, if a critical mass within a group speaks a certain language, then success within that group is dependent upon speaking that same language as well. So even if someone else speaks a different language, they have to learn the native tongue to survive. And the concept was extended to discuss the notion of religion. And throughout the world, a belief in a religion is becoming a minority view, and that a belief or active practice of religion is becoming a minority view, and the prevalent or majoritarian view is a sense that people don't have strong religious beliefs. They're governed by utilitarian concerns. And, you know, these various scientists and anthropologists were talking about this reaching close to a tipping point. And if it reaches the tipping point, according to these generally held scientific beliefs, then the rest of the population will begin to conform because that's what the prevalent standard will be. And if you look at actions by, for instance, the Tea Party, that can be seen as consistent with this notion that we're reaching a tipping point within the culture, and the Tea Party or people advocating strong religious beliefs may feel like they're losing, and they're engaging in conduct that is characteristic of someone who's starting to get desperate, and they're fighting it at all costs. And what these people, scientists and whatnot, are suggesting is that from a macro perspective, it may be a losing battle. And the same thing with respect to the climate. You know, I have tremendous concerns about the stability of the planet Earth, and the planet Earth can also reach a tipping point if we do certain things, and it may not be able to come back. Anyway, those are sort of the themes that inspired these last few thoughts, and it comes from Through the Wormhole, so I apologize for the digression, but that's what I was thinking.
Okay, obviously I have to ask Gary, because this is definitely right up your alleyway, as us Brits would say. Do you agree or disagree with Peter?
I really, 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 really want to agree with him. I just don't, you know, I've heard this a lot, that the religious faction, the churches are are going, search attendance is going down and so forth. I just think that what's going to happen is that the Republicans are going to take the Senate. And if you listen to the hearings this week about the senators, one out of 100, one out of 100, you know, of 100 people in the United States say, no, there's no climate change. I'm not convinced. These people are anti-science. And it's just, you know, I want Peter to be so right. And I'm sure there are a lot of facts that support him. I just have this very pessimistic view of our country right now. I just have this very pessimistic view. And when I hear what's going on with the polling and things like that, it just makes me a little bit despondent. I just feel kind of like, really, are you kidding me? Like, why don't we learn after being knocked on our behinds about 10 times? I just don't understand it. So I hope Peter's right.
Okay, and Sam, this sounds like your kind of topic.
When it comes to religion, everyone, you know, Ethiopia for the masses. Probably been one of the lines I've always followed. But you know, what do you expect in a country where the number one box office success of the weekend is Peabody versus Sherman, Peabody and Sherman? I mean, what do you expect, guys? I mean, that's a kind of popular culture and everything. Of course, people are flocking to see animated movies, and I think that's great and wonderful. And I'm more upset that one of the great comedians of our time, because I know time's running short, Simon, so I'm going to say this, is that David Brenner, you were great.
Yeah. Didn't he appear a record-breaking 75 times on
Carson? Johnny Carson loved him because he was very, if you look at his brand of humor that a lot of people copied from, he was kind of groundbreaking. And he was, and let's face it, he was funny in a different sort of way. He wasn't crude, and he had a engaging personality. I mean, he was Seinfeld before Seinfeld. But look, he was to be on the Tonight Show, I think what really did him in is when Carson left, everyone thought Brenner was going to get it to be the guest host, and it went to Jay Leno. His career kind of took a major stumbling. But anyway, I agree. I think that, you know, like I said, religion is the opiate for the masses. I didn't say it, Mark said it. He's right. And Peter, everything was going down but one thing this weekend. How about that pat down for that TSA, that poor woman from the TSA I sent you?
You just can't get off that, can you?
Top of the day, I want to leave out early. Just want to tell you, everybody have a great St. Patrick's Day, great show, and all that. I had some guests who've come in for some corned beef and cabbage and some green beer. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Terrific time today. Don't drink too much tomorrow.
All right. Bill, do you have any thoughts on, you know, religion going down?
I think this has been a very interesting show. Really held my attention more than some other things that I didn't have anything to participate in. I think that one of the things that we want to make sure is, I think that religion has to be preserved in some way, though. You have to have a certain amount of personal conviction and personal belief, and if that's under the guise of religion, then that is a good thing. It's good that you conform and that you're tolerant of other religions, but let's not scrap the whole thing, because it's important for people to have that personal conviction and their how close they're going to be to their deity, and keep this in mind without it transgressing and causing other people so much pain.
Okay, who's watching TV? Because it's coming across loud and clear.
Everybody have a great weekend, you know?
Yes, Simon. I don't know who
it
is.
I can hear those leprechauns everywhere, and I wish everyone the luck of the Irish and a pot of gold at the end of their rainbow.
Okay. My guess is it was Sam. Oh, I got something to beat him up over tomorrow. And anyway, gentlemen, it has been delightful. I'm going to go once around the table, and we can wrap this up. I'm going to start with you, Gary. Your parting thoughts for us today?
Sure. My parting thoughts is I wish everyone well. As far as the idea of the underdog being a number one movie, wait till Noah's Ark with Russell Crowe comes out. And I really do think that it's a much more dangerous position. But outside of me just not being able to stop ranting, everyone have a great St. Patrick's Day. Be well.
Okay. And Peter.
Happy St. Paddy's Day, everyone, and all the best to everyone.
Okay. And Bill?
I hope that this is a good week for everyone and that they enjoy St. Patrick's Day and that we're looking forward to next weekend.
Right, and we will be back next Sunday. Until then, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, safe, and healthy week. Until next Sunday, goodbye.